Coming up on Tech News Today, executives keep leaving Android. Skype's going 3D eventually. Twitter's adding lines to your timeline. And Facebook spam will make you rich. All that and more next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, August 29th, 2013. Yes, it's still August. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT8. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zachter.
And I'm Jason Hell.
Tom Merritt is on assignment, sort of. He's at Dragon Con having a great time. But we will continue with the news today and tomorrow, starting, as we do each time, with the top 10 stories of the day in the News Fuse. Finish. Well, earlier this year, Andy Rubin, the creator of Android, sort of abruptly stepped down from the team, and now another executive is on his way out. Hugo Barra, vice president of project management for Android, is leaving for a job as vice president of Xiaomi Global. Xiaomi is a Chinese company which builds Android phones and handles both hardware and software that runs on top of Android. Barra joined Google in March of 2008 and came first from speech technology firm Nuance.
The feature creep in Twitter continues. Twitter has altered the way it shows conversations on its app and on the web. There's now a blue vertical line showing the tweets in your stream that are connected. You'll see up to 3 tweets in the conversation in your stream with the option to expand if you want to see the whole Yap Fest. Of course, there are, with any Twitter change, people are really upset. And in other news, apparently no one I follow talks to each other.
Skype is 10 years young and celebrating by going 3D. Microsoft's corporate vice president for Skype, Mark Gillette, told the BBC in an interview that the company has created a 3D solution. But don't get too excited just yet. This technology might still be years away. Gillette says that while many TVs and computers carry 3D capability, the capture devices are not yet there. Quote, as we work with that kind of technology, you have to add multiple cameras to your computer, precisely calibrate them, and point them at the right angle.
You know, I miss talking about Twitter. So here's some more Twitter news.
Yeah.
Twitter just bought social TV tracking service Trender. All Things D says that Twitter will kill off Trender's analytics product after all the company's current contracts are up. Trender was also behind the product Curator, which let companies curate a timeline of tweets around a specific event.
Their R button is broken.
What's the R's?
R's. Verizon and Vodafone are back at it in talks of a buyout. Verizon wants to buy back Vodafone's stake in their U.S. wireless joint venture in a deal that could cost Verizon over $100 billion, say people familiar with the matter. And that Verizon is in discussions with banks about the tens of billions of dollars in loans it would need to complete the deal.
The BlackBerry Q10, not to be confused with the Q10 bus I used to ride in Queens, is not selling too well. According to the Wall Street Journal, one retailer who operates 16 stores said that he saw, quote, virtually no demand for the Q10 and eventually returned most to the equipment vendor. Used phone dealers are also not seeing an influx of BlackBerry devices that you typically see when an updated device shows up. The Q10 went on sale at Verizon and AT&T earlier this summer. BlackBerry hasn't disclosed any sales numbers on the Q10.
TMO News reports that T-Mobile is planning blackout dates between September 20th and September 22nd, which, if true, sound very iPhone-related. This lines up with previous rumors that September 20th is a potential actual launch day for the next-generation iPhone, whether it's called the 5S or something else. Or maybe it's related to a Note 3 launch, which is expected to be announced on September 4th. Does a Note 3 launch warrant an all-hands-on-deck situation at T-Mobile? If I had any money to bet, which I do not, I would go with Apple.
But it's all wrists. It's Galaxy Gear Watch. Instapaper just got a redesign. The Read Later service was bought by BetaWorks in April. The web version of Instapaper is the first property to get a new look. It still relies heavily on text, but uses a two-column layout similar to the iOS app. BetaWorks says to expect updated iOS and Android apps in the next coming weeks.
Every company should be bought by BetaWorks. They take things really seriously, yeah. UK mobile operator 3 has released a rollout schedule and pricing details for its 4G launch. The first three cities to get 4G will be London, Birmingham, and Manchester, beginning in December. And 3 says it will speed up the process in January to cover 50 more UK cities before the end of 2014 and eventually get to about 90% of the population by the end of 2015. Once 3's 4G service has been switched on in your town, if you live in the UK, an over-the-air software upgrade is all that's going to be required, as long as you already have a 4G-capable phone.
Because they are in the future, New Zealand has decided to ban software patents. A new bill passed by a vote of 117-4 that states a computer program is not an invention. This designation as not an invention would make programs ineligible for patent protection. However, processes are still patentable if the computer program is a way of implementing a patentable process.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the fastest and easiest way to create a high-quality website or blog. It's an all-in-one platform, really, that makes it pretty easy to put together something that's very, very professional and works for you. You can send a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website and hashtag TNT Squarespace if you'd like us to take a look at it. In fact, one of the blogs that we'd like to look at is Just Another Beer Blog. It's perfect for Ayaz and me. We love beer. Just Another Beer Blog.
True story.
we want to mention people's sites. We want to mention actual real sites that you've built out there to give people an idea of what they can put together. Blogs are put together with a variety of different templates. This particular one is clearly about beer. It's got a nice little banner there. You put together your own background color. What's nice about Squarespace is it also looks good on mobile devices. So you can put together something that looks great on the web, but you know how some sites, they just don't render right on your iPhone or your Android device or your tablet. So Squarespace puts together a variety of versions of these sites and reconfigures the design depending on who is looking at your site and when. Quench Your Visual Thirst section on Just Another Beer Blog is kind of fun. It's got a little slider, makes it easy to browse images. They've got an auto-publish feature for Instagram, variety of stuff that Squarespace will pull in, depending on where you hang out online in the social spaces. It's a lovely, lovely blog. If you're interested in putting together your own Squarespace blog, and they really do have some great templates to get you started, you can just start a trial today, no credit card required, and start building your website. When you decide to sign up at the end of your trial, use the offer code TNT and then the number 8. That's TNT8. And you'll get 10% off your new account. And, you know, you can show your support for Tech News Today all at the same time. Don't forget, we want to see your Squarespace sites. Don't forget to send a tweet with the hashtag TNT Squarespace. And we could choose your Squarespace site to mention on a future episode of this show. Start your free trial now. You're going to love Squarespace. I know I do. And thanks to Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to talk about, in a little bit more depth, the stories of the day is none other than Dan Patterson, reporter for Some All. That's not the way. That's a different byline than when you were last on the show, Dan.
Well, I've been at Some All for, a year and a half or so. But, I was running CoPoint, and that went away. So, you know, now it's data journalism.
It's all Some all the time. All right. Well, thanks for being with us again. And we're going to start with, this is a pretty big story. It broke yesterday after we had our show. Ayaz, what's going on with Android and Hugo Barra leaving? Yeah. What does it all mean?
Yeah, Hugo Barra is leaving Google, and he's heading to, is it Xiaomi? Is that how you pronounce this?
That's how I pronounce it.
Well, we'll be consistent. Xiaomi. Barra was the VP of product management for Android. You might remember him as the guy who was showing off the new Nexus 7 at launch. That's how I remember him. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. All Things D says that Barra tendered his resignation before the end of a romantic relationship that someone else at the company who was apparently is now seeing Sergey Brin. So this is like this other personal thing that's going on, apparently. All Things D sources say that Barra's decision to leave the company is unrelated to that whatsoever. Barra announced on Google Plus he's joining Xiaomi in China as the VP of Xiaomi's global, I guess, division. And the next web says that Barra is going to start in October. Now, back in March, Android head Andy Rubin left the Android team, but he's still at Google. Sundar Pichai became the head of Google of Chrome apps and Android at that point. And if you're wondering about Xiaomi, if they sound new to you, we've talked about them before. They've gotten the tagline, the Apple of China. Sometimes they claim they want to be more like the Amazon of China. They produce affordable smartphones. The company has built a reputation around its brand, kind of like a cult kind of thing, like Apple's got going. They also make something called the Mi UI, which is a custom version of Android that lets the user personalize their phones via themes. So if you're looking at the video version right now, you'll see what looks to be something that looks very iPhone-ish, but this is actually an Android skin that Xiaomi has come up with. Dan, where do you see Android going at Google with both Rubin and Barra gone?
Well, it's very difficult to tell with a departure like this. It's often easy to conflate the personal stuff with the professional stuff, and not knowing what happened, you know, to the granular level of detail internally, it's hard to tell if this was a product decision that affects Android or if this is more of a personal thing that's like not my business. But I think what this says about Android is that this is new blood time. This is a season for new ideas to come into Google and for a company that, you know, has a nice tie to its roots and its legacy. It may be actually a good thing to see new blood and new ideas come in.
It seems more like, let's put the personal stuff aside. A lot of people wanted to jump on that. And it sounds like, well, you know, maybe it's a factor, maybe it isn't. But nobody's disputing the fact that Barra is going to a company that prides itself on good hardware, on skins on top of Android that the company thinks makes it better. And he's got a lot of experience here. And it looks like, you know, maybe it's more of a factor of my work here was done at Android, and I'd like to work on a different version of this OS.
I know that it's very easy to. I mean, we love the personal juice of drama, but I think the Xiaomi story might actually be the more interesting angle for the exact reasons that you just said. You know, this is, or at least could be perceived as China's Apple, and for a guy from Google to go to, you know, China is the world's largest expanding market, and I think that could prove to yield some very interesting results.
Yeah, Barra's knowledge of Android's got to be somewhat complete, because if he's at the company for over 5 years, we've seen Android change a lot in the past 5 years. That's been a huge shift in the way that's been developed. The amount of customization that could be done with Xiaomi software would be interesting, but the fact that he's part of it, he's the first VP global of Xiaomi global. So the thing is, we could see a really big expansion. We've seen a bunch of companies in China trying to get to the U.S. Lenovo's trying to get their phones over here, trying to make a splash. But by having Google's own guy over as Xiaomi, I'm very curious about what kind of impact that will have if we're going to start seeing this company become a major player around the globe, including the U.S.
All right, let's move on to something that also spawned a lot of controversy yesterday, and that's Twitter's new Conversations design and feature. This is new for both the web version of Twitter and iOS and Android app versions of Twitter. So the deal is, if you, for some reason, haven't been on Twitter or don't use these particular native apps and haven't noticed, is we now see these lines that are connecting tweets. It's been a little confusing to some of us who are used to using Twitter all day, every day. Up to 3 tweets in a conversation now will be sort of grouped. They'll be grouped on a home timeline. So if Ayaz tweets something and I respond to Ayaz and Dan responds to Ayaz, all of a sudden we now have a group of tweets. So fourth person, person D, let's call them, could look at their timeline and say, oh, I see, Ayaz started a conversation and here are more replies. Now, by default, there will be 3 tweets shown as part of a threaded conversation. If you were to click on one of these tweets, the conversation would expand to include replies from people that you aren't following that wouldn't show up by default in your timeline. This is something that might be interested if you say, well, this is a very interesting topic, even though I don't follow this random person. That person was engaging with Ayaz and Dan and Sarah, so I can get a little bit more context that way. Bruce Daisy, who's the UK director of Twitter, even mentioned to himself, it takes a little getting used to. He actually tweeted, while the reporting is the big story, I think you're going to love Conversation View. It drove me crazy for a week, and now I can't do without it, which I sort of feel is probably inevitable for the rest of us. I found the whole thing extremely confusing at first because I'm so used to most recent tweet at the top. But with conversations of tweets, if you started a conversation that I responded to 5 minutes later, now my response is under you.
The originating tweet actually floats up higher.
Originating tweet, yeah, becomes up at the top. So we're sort of going in two different directions. But then I thought of it like the Facebook timeline. Well, that's how Facebook timeline works. Most recent stuff at the top. But if we start a conversation, then you get your little responses in line in a threaded comments view. It seems to me and to other people that this is probably Twitter's way to make newbies to the system be able to follow along better. I think Twitter probably is still a bit of a confusing place for somebody who says, oh, I heard Twitter's a great place to, you know, follow celebrities and my friends and that sort of thing. The normals, as we call them. We know Twitter wants to IPO sooner than later. Dan, do you think that this is just an inevitable way to try to make Twitter make more sense to the general public, even if it kind of screws over some power users?
Well, I think that there are a number of ways to look at the story. All of these different angles are very interesting. There's certainly the product angle, which is just like you said, it's a way to make, I don't know if you remember, Twitter in 2006 and 7 was just this jarring stream of like, what the heck? And you know, opening that platform or allowing it to be more accessible to new people is certainly something, or to existing users, is certainly something that is of great concern to the company. But I think the very interesting angle on this is the business story. And the business story, I think, is that, you know, with the seemingly inevitable IPO, something like this does a few things for Twitter. It increases time spent on site. It increases the user engagement. And as we know, Twitter has, you know, since kind of killing off the developer ecosystem, has been focusing on Twitter.com as a destination, much like Facebook.com as a destination. So I think that things like this increase the engagement on the site and keep people active. It may, you know, if you take the millions of people that Twitter has and increase engagement by like 0.01%, that has real value when it comes down to an IPO, and they need to do this before going public.
I think it's kind of strange because what Twitter used to be is a timeline, an actual timeline. Yeah. Now what we're doing is we're reordering things now. Like that's why one of the reasons I ended up calling it a stream. It's really kind of like what Google Plus has going for it. It's what Facebook's done recently. To have things shift that way does make sense if you're trying to follow a conversation. But what if you just wanted Twitter the way it was? Those people would get angry. But the thing that Twitter's been so good about is when they add these features, they're not so horrible. You're not going to – it's totally changed something. They've just been adding these features slowly and this small scale. A blue line might not annoy anybody. They might not even notice it because it's that Twitter blue line. It's like, okay, not a big deal.
Well, you know, and on the web version of Twitter, that blue line can be any hex code you want it to be. You just go into your design settings. You change your link color. Like I changed mine to red. So my links, I mean, it's going to be the same thing as a linkable username, for example, but you can change the color of the line.
That I bet will be great for Coca-Cola and companies that really like to have this, have the conversation with their color. I'm not kidding about companies that really are passionate about their colors, like T-Mobile.
Sure.
With Magenta, I think they're suing AT&T over the usage of that color, actually. So it's not such a huge deal. I don't think the response to the outcry to the change, I think that's going to die out pretty quickly.
I mean, I remember when Twitter first hid responses to people that I'm following that I don't follow. And I went crazy. I was like, this should be my decision, not yours, Twitter. And I mean, I can't even imagine having that now. It would be such a noise fest. Then remember when Twitter implemented its own native version of the retweet. So you don't have to say RT and then add what the original tweet was. And everybody went crazy. How could they do this? This should be our, this is the syntax that we, the users, created. Now when I see an old school RT, I kind of get annoyed, like, pushing that on me. So it is an evolution of Twitter. Obviously, the people at Twitter who are involved in UI and design have thought a lot about this, and they feel like this makes the most sense to ease up on confusion. So it's probably more a case of those of us who have been around a while fearing change.
Change is okay.
Change is okay.
Just hashtag change is okay.
Except when it isn't. Hey, let's talk about Skype changing into a 3D company?
Something like that, Well, interview.
Part of a company.
There was an interview with the BBC because of Skype's 10th anniversary. Microsoft's corporate VP of Skype, Mark Gillett, says Skype's working on 3D video calls. He says the company has done work in the labs looking at the capability of 3D screens and 3D capture. He says customers have a lot of 3D-capable displays these days, TVs, monitors, and such. But the capture devices just aren't there yet. It's not like you got 3D cameras on every laptop or your smartphone just yet. He says, we have it in the lab. We know how to make it work, and we're looking at the ecosystem of devices and their capability to support it in order to make a decision when we might think about bringing something like that to market. So very non-committal there. He's unsure if we'll see 3D cameras on cell phones. He also says Skype's going to stay cross-platform, by the way, so you'll be able to see support on something like the PS4, even though Microsoft has the Xbox. Dan, 3D video chats. We're doing video chat right now. Do you want to do this in 3D?
Can't you just wait to touch the beard? Pull. It's hard to tell if something like this is a leading indicator of where the market may actually be headed, or if this is the most hilarious gimmick of the month. I mean, I think that I could... I really think that I can see this as something that the technology provided works okay. Something that with Skype could actually tug on some heartstrings and be something that is a feature that people want and use, except that it is 3D, and who wants 3D?
I can't imagine ever the way that I use Skype. Well, obviously we use it for the show every day, but otherwise, let's just say in general, it would be for some sort of a remote work conversation here and there. I mean, the whole thing about 3D that I find fun is every once in a while, and I'm not even crazy about 3D movies, but every once in a while, especially when it's an animated movie or something, it's visually exciting. I don't feel that way about my coworkers. Not that you're not visually exciting, but, you know, I'm looking at you in 3D. I'm
visually excited. She's very wrong.
Well,
think about military families and people who rely on Skype as a means of staying in touch. At least the military is what I jump to. And I think that I could see this, particularly if it was on mobile devices at home, an easier way for 3D to become adopted. But right, I mean, there isn't a compelling reason for 3D other than it looks pretty.
Well, and also consider this aspect. Unless they do this glasses free, you want to do this this 3D, both sides are wearing these funky red and blue glasses. So, okay, you finally get that opportunity to talk to that person that's overseas in the military, and you're wearing these stupid little glasses just to get this, like, pretend 3D effect. It sounds like a... Yeah, a lost.
Well, and think about how much more controlled the environments will have to be, too. If you're going to show up in 3D, the lighting has to be just so. You can't be moving around too much. It's like...
Well, that's why I think maybe 3DS, kind of cheaper 3D technology. Yeah, if it's on a mobile device, let's say an Android device in 4 years ships with some kind of cheap 3D on it. Like, I could see it being a why not, you know, a Samsung kind of will throw the kitchen sink at it feature. Maybe.
Get into the holograph world Skype, and you have something.
I just want to jump right over the 3D thing.
Yes, Intel. 3D has already been proven, hasn't it, that it's pretty much a gimmick? And it's a gimmick in ways that, like, make sense on paper, right? Like, I'm going to see this great big movie with all this action, and 3D is a perfect application for it, and still people think that that's not the best way to see movies and that they don't like the 3D effect. What about like a conference call? Like, that doesn't make any sense at all.
I think there's more to it than just the one-on-one person-person call. I think there might be a business aspect in this. If I'm showing off a model of something I've made and you want to actually see it, obviously you're not going to be able to manipulate it through Skype. Because, hey, could you turn around that thing that you've actually built with your 3D printer or something that way with Skype? I'm thinking of that kind of technology because we've talked about, I think it was this week, Intel is working on a 3D camera for your laptop, so it'll be able to sense the depth, kind of like the Kinect. You'd be able to have 3D scans. You might be able to use that with something like Skype. So I think the gimmick of it being like, hey, look, you can see me and the bookshelf 5 feet away from me, that's not so cool. But if you can actually show off items and objects that actually have a visual interest or that actually are important to get that feel, because 2D doesn't always take care of everything. 3D, I think this is interesting because that means Skype is still working on some weird stuff.
Well, and I tend to think of Skype as like a one-on-one conversation, but imagine the possibilities if it was a CEO that was delivering some sort of a speech to a large number of employees that were somewhere else where they'd be in an auditorium and maybe they're wearing glasses and the person giving the speech isn't and it would actually be something that would be more compelling to everybody. I don't know. I'm still trying. I still think it's...
You don't like change, remember? That's okay.
It sounds like I don't have to worry about it for a while. All right. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ProXPN. Your online freedom and privacy are under threat. We talk about it all the time, and you should be worried. But governments and ISPs want to control what you can and cannot see. They want to keep a record of everything you do. Free Wi-Fi at the local coffee house or maybe that hotel you're staying in at the airport. Not really all that secure because your passwords and your sensitive data can be intercepted. That's why ProXPN is such a good solution. It's a global VPN, virtual private network, works with almost any internet connection, and it gives you an encrypted tunnel, a secure one, where your online data passes through. Pretty much any online application can work with ProXPN. Your browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs, if you do a lot of that. ProXPN keeps everything you do hidden from people who might be interested in what you're doing, and it disguises your physical location as well. Gives you access to any website or online service, no matter where you are or where you might be traveling to. Works with OpenVPN or PPTP, it's your choice. You can bypass internet filtering, bypass blocked websites, bypass geographical restrictions. A lot of our audience knows about that for internet content, online videos, with worldwide servers in the US, the UK, Asia, and more. Best of all, software is for Windows and Mac, and it offers advanced controls so you can select the programs and the ports that you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. Really puts you in control. By the way, OS and Android devices are supported too. You can use it with your public or corporate Wi-Fi for complete and total privacy on the go. That is ProXPN. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. Again, that's proxpn.com/twit. Premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we have a special offer. Use the code TNT and you will receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's not a day, a week, or a month. That's a lifetime of your account. ProXPN.com/twit. Use that code TNT for 20% off. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right. Ayaz and I were talking this morning about my ambitious decision to talk about the Syrian government and waging internet war on them.
Total difference as opposed to like kittens and puppies that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Good decision, though.
You know, Ayaz. Yeah, you know, I thought Dan Patterson is with us and he pays so much attention to these issues. And I just wanted to do my best to tackle it. Washington Post has a story, a really interesting story about an American hacker who goes under the pseudonym Oliver Tuckett, who had contacted them and had obtained copies of some Syrian government documents. He said he got off a hacked server. He basically said, you know, and this story goes into a lot more detail on the Post's post, says that Syria's IT systems really aren't secure at all. He was wanting to embarrass the Assad regime and said, you know, I could go in and take control of a variety of things. Now, this goes both ways. Obviously, Syria-related entities have also had their own attacks. Syrian Electronic Army, as recently as earlier this week, has targeted a variety of Twitter accounts, the New York Times, variety of sites, and shown strength in that sense. But Tuckett says a lot of the email traffic that's flowing around just simply isn't encrypted. Why? He doesn't necessarily know, but says the Syrian regime seems like is, as far as the technical aspects of information flowing, has its head in other places. He says he has been able to dig into a site associated with the Iranian Foreign Ministry over the past few months, as well as domains in China. He was able to read messages. He actually took control of syr.gov.sy for several days before Syria apparently kind of took it back. I guess I read things like this and I think, all right, well, if Tuckett has done this, my guess is he's probably not the only one who's done it or at least has the capabilities. Dan, how much damage does this actually really do to any regime? You know, it's Syria right now, but does, when we're talking about actual civil war and how other countries should get involved, how much does something like this kind of attack mean?
Well, I think what's very interesting about a story like this is, first, the technology story is very interesting on prima facie, looking at how, you know, the Times being hacked and Twitter being hacked, how companies secure DNS and that kind of thing. That's very interesting on its own. But when we get involved with a situation like Syria, So I've covered the UN for 5 years, and I've worked in and around foreign policy communities. And generally, there is an atmosphere of don't trust anything. If you're hearing this story, don't trust it on its surface. Now, the Washington Post, of course, is impeccable with their sourcing, and I generally tend to trust what they say and that they have checked the veracity of who is telling them certain things. But when it comes, particularly a civil war like this, where it's not very clear what side is the morally right side to be on. You know, of course, the rebels in Syria made up a large part of Al-Qaeda. And the United States State Department has a long history of, or at least a history in the past administration of doing some interesting things when it comes to technology. So I wish I could answer your question. I don't really know what to make of this story right now, other than it's ongoing and it's very hard to tell who is hacking who. I mean, is this guy who he says he is? Is this the CIA? And I don't mean that to be hyperbolic. I just mean that this is what the CIA does. I have several friends and former colleagues who are now in clandestine services, and they won't talk, but they will tell you, you know, this is the things, the indications of our type of language, the things we would say and the way we would communicate. And this doesn't seem to be, a professional. This does seem to be an individual. But man, I would love to talk about this story all day long, but I don't think I'm capable of drawing any real specific conclusions about this right now. You know, particularly with this, what we're leading up to, or it looks like we're leading up to some type of military intervention, and that is often predicated by whispers and noise like this. You know, you will see small hacks, or you'll see small engagements that in retrospect you can kind of put the pieces together, but it's just real hard to tell, especially now, this being the Thursday before something will happen.
Yeah, I mean, security experts that the Post talked to say, I mean, this guy, he seems to be who he says he is, and he seems to have gained quite a bit of access, knows what he's doing. But I wonder just how much does that play into if there was some sort of government initiative? If he doesn't work with the government in any capacity, well, then what happens?
Yeah, was this just somebody who said, I want to hack stuff in Syria? I mean, it very well could have been. I mean, particularly during the last engagement that we had, you know, I know a lot of the guys at Blip TV here in New York, we had meetings and we sat down. We were like, well, how can we help out? I mean, can we provide technology resources in the Arab Spring? And that was, you know, a little less ambiguous about what was happening, but you know, who knows?
Well, perhaps we should go to something that we do know, and that is Yahoo updating part of its services once again.
Yeah, this is like a chaser, isn't it? It's like this really heavy thing. This is a palate cleanser. So there is.
It's great, though. I mean, it's wonderful to talk about this stuff because this is a tech story as well, you know?
Yeah.
So we're going to move on to Yahoo's new Flickr app.
Our pickleback.
What?
Pickleback, you know, when you chase a... Never mind.
Okay. I have to look up some words after the show. So Yahoo's got a new Flickr app for iOS. It's got something called Live Filters. We're going to actually show you how that works right now. Assuming airplane mirroring is still working, you're going to see this. So this is what the Flickr app looks like. It's still just for iPhones and iPod touches. There's no iPad app yet. And you can apply filters live. You can see Jason moving his hand. It's a lovely hand. He's doing his Miss America pageant wave. That's really great. So there it is. And you can just take photos of that way. The other thing that they've added is grids. Now, there doesn't seem to be any obvious way to have grids. Thanks for tweeting, whoever's doing that right now.
That was me.
Thanks, you, Sarah.
Sorry.
You can add grids. So if you want to do the rule of thirds, or you want to do, I don't know which rule this is, there's some golden ratios, a whole bunch of grids. It might be hard to see in the compressed version, but there's lots of different ways you can compose your images this way. And then you can obviously take photos. There's a lot of ways you can actually alter these photos even after you've taken it. So thanks again for that. We can actually change the filter after we've taken it. So we had the live preview, but if you didn't like that, you can still change it. All kinds of pro tools involved now. We got cropping as an option. We can also do all kinds of color shifts if we want. There's just a lot of tools that you have now. You can change the levels of different colors. You can see the impact it's having there. We've got sliders for color balance. There's a ton of filters. You're actually able to customize the filters. Now, all of that being said, Dan, with all these features, is that enough to get people on board with this older brand? I mean, Flickr now seems like it's the grandpa of photo sharing.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what their user acquisition strategy is other than becoming feature complete with something like this. This is a really cool thing to see. And of course, Flickr is near and dear to my heart. But I don't know that features are enough to simply to acquire customers, which is what Flickr needs to do now. So it's beautiful. I love it. But I think it's too little too late for Flickr.
I love this app. I am so impressed by it. And I pretty much download any photography app on iOS. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is one of the best ones that I've seen, especially for just some of the pro tools that it incorporates that are easy to use. I feel like Flickr's always been good about that. It's always been good about saying, hey, this is a site that professionals should be utilizing. But if you're not one, that's cool, too. It's a community. But I agree with you, Dan. I think I've had a Flickr account since 2005. I haven't used Flickr regularly except to cross-post from things like Instagram for years now. And I don't see what is going to compel me to come back because the trends have just changed. Flickr, for whatever reason, variety of reasons really, stagnated some years back, has a lot of competition. And I was taking a picture of me, which just shows that Flickr isn't quite dead yet. Well,
there's the live. What about the live function of this? Now, there are some other applications. I think Path lets you do some of the live filters.
Path does,
Instagram doesn't yet. They just added what do they call it? They call it straightening. That's their major new feature.
Instagram will let you add filters to videos. It will. But
is that in post or is that live?
No, it's live.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, yeah, that's a new thing. I just feel like... And this is a problem not just for Flickr, but for a lot of Yahoo properties, at least in my opinion. And who knows? Maybe I'll be proved wrong that these are going to be great, great services that people have simply moved on from. How many big, big sites like Flickr can you think of that were popular 8 years ago that have come back somehow? I can't think of one.
Yahoo bought a lot of them.
So BetaWorks has to buy this?
Yeah,
BetaWorks.
Right. We'll solve it.
BetaWorks, buy Flickr. Give it new life. It's a great app. It's just I just don't know
how they're going to get
how do you do
new
it
new users.
How do you do it? It's like the MySpace of photo sharing.
Yeah.
It's like they have a ton of pro features. I think that's a really good hook, but I just don't know how they're going to compete with the cooler brands.
They have to change the user behavior from being a photo dump, like you said, Sarah. I do the same with my Flickr account. I just cross post there, which is a really passive type of behavior. It means that we are becoming strains on Flickr's resources without actively adding, you know, as a user, as somebody who logs in and is monetizable, we're just a drain on the resources. And without seeing some way of getting us to come back and use it as a photo origination point, it's going to be real tricky.
Well, speaking of tricky, this is how to get rid of spammers on Facebook. Let's finish up with this story. I guess if you're a wannabe spammer, it looks pretty good. Andrea Stroppa and Carlo Di Michele, who are leaders of an Italian research team, have uncovered some price lists for posting third-party links to Facebook fan pages that are otherwise known as spam. They identified spam a variety of ways. They identified spam via use of certain phrases like, hey, click here for a free Android device, followed by a link to a site that's outside the network that they could track. They included sites where spammers set up fake fan pages in order to get Facebook users to like those pages and then clicked on links that they shared, which, by the way, is against the Facebook terms of service, but there are a lot of these, and Facebook relies on the public to report spam, so it's a bit of a whack-a-mole project. They were also able to track URLs to outside sites because the spammers often use shortening services like TinyURL and Bit.ly, which are legitimate sharing services. And you can track and figure out how many people click on that link. That's all public information, and that's why those services are great for legitimate use. And they found 9% of the pages that users were directed to by spammers used Google's AdSense. So Google is actually profiting from this in an indirect way. Also, on the money side, not that I'm saying you should be a spammer, but if you wanted to be a spammer, pages analyzed bring in a revenue of about 18,000 posts per day. If you times that by the revenue per post, it's ranging from about $13 to $58, 365 days a year per post, which puts a spammer's earning range in between $87 million and $390 million.
We're in the wrong business.
I know. Weighted average to about $200 million annually. okay, that sounds pretty good. Now, obviously, you have to get people to click on links. It's not just, you can't just be a spammer. But a lot of people do click on links, and that's why it's such a problem for Facebook. In fact, spammers setting up their own fan pages, attracting users to them. Let's say I'm a spammer and I put together a Grumpy Cat fan page. There are a lot of those out there. Well, I'm not pretending to be a site that I'm not. I'm just a fan page. You get a lot of people to participate. Then once you have enough likes on a page and people who are following, you start selling links on it to third-party services. This is how it works. I feel like Facebook has a real problem on its hands because these are people who arguably are the most active on Facebook because they have a monetary incentive. The rest of us are just trying to connect to each other, right? We're not making a lot of money off Facebook, or very few of us, unless you're participating in Facebook advertising. Dan, is reporting spam up to the users going to be the downfall of Facebook? Or do they have to open up their another larger spam whack-a-mole unit? What's the answer here?
Well, it will be very interesting to see how this works for Facebook. I imagine that if they can mechanize some of the spam reporting, that it will probably at least impact their bottom line a little bit, because it's fewer human resources doing what a machine can do. But I also think that, exactly like you said, there is a huge aftermarket for these, you know, buy likes, buy Twitter followers, you know, those kind of services. And these things aren't going away. You can read, you know, Slate has done large features on these people and the companies that sell likes. And I think when there is an incentivized aftermarket for something like this, there's not a whole lot of reason to change the ecosystem. So it will be interesting. I'm excited to see how this plays out over the next year or so.
Ayaz, do you find Facebook spam being a big part of your Facebook experience? It's a big part of mine, but I do think that Facebook seems to be able to auto-hide a vast majority of it, at least on the conversations that I'm having.
I haven't experienced enough Facebook spam. It's just because I'm usually not on Facebook that often. Right. I'll flick through it, or I'll be on Flipboard.
It's a great way to avoid it.
Yeah, where's the spam? It could be there. I haven't seen it very often. Mostly, I think it's just a usage thing. So if people have a monetary incentive to keep doing this, and if they're actually making money on this, mm-hmm. it's going to work. It's the same thing why spammers exist with email, right? If people click, that's what gets the money. They're very happy that way. I don't know if Facebook wants to do some kind of educational thing saying don't click these links, but if they are doing all the work on the back end and I don't see the spam myself, maybe that'll help. Or maybe you just have to not like as many things. Maybe you like Grumpy Cat and you like this and that and the other thing, and that's why they're showing up. But I probably like four things on Facebook right now.
Facebook's also, I mean, they're over a billion users strong. So that's where all the people are. So that's where the spammers go. I mean, it makes sense, certainly. And yeah, if you couldn't make money this way, then spammers would move on to something else. But clearly you can. And quite a bit of it, actually. I don't know. Stop spamming. We hate you.
Spammer's bad.
Yeah. Okay. Spammer's bad. Mm-hmm. Let's go shopping. Actually, let's look at the randomizer. All right, what are the results of our straw poll?
All right, so we had three choices. Yeah. The University of St. Andrews scientists create fastest man-made spinning object versus College Humor's tech ad spoof, which is funny because it's true. And then there was a third option of you can now track sharks off the East Coast in real time. And if you don't know, when we're doing the show live, we have a straw poll, and we have a bunch of choices that you have for the randomizer. And currently, the winner is the University of St. Andrews scientists create fastest man-made spinning object, which I was fearing would win 48 votes out of 118, because I had to learn what the heck happened, because I'm reading the story throughout the show.
Well, that it's a microscopic sphere, mm-hmm. so it's a tiny little thing. It's like a mega dreidel, but really small.
They can spin a nano dreidel.
They can spin up to 600 million revolutions per minute.
Mm-hmm. And that sphere appeared to vanish. The researchers don't know what happened to it. That's the other thing. They're trying to find out what happens to objects when you're pushing it to the extreme. They're saying this is going to help shed light on the area of quantum friction. Not something I was thinking about this morning. I am now thinking about quantum friction. I will be thinking about it all day. Dan, are you ready to start spinning at that speed?
Yeah, right. That's exactly how I feel. I wasn't curious about this until now, and now I need to learn more.
Well, the spin speed of this object is apparently 500,000 times faster than a domestic washing machine, More than 1,000 times faster than a dental drill.
I love that they've compared it to a washing machine. I guess that gives you an idea.
What are other things that spin? Spin cycles.
600 million revolutions per minute.
Let's put this in a context that the people can understand. So you spin so much that you create some sort of a black hole and you time travel. That's what's happening here, right?
I don't know what happened to it so far.
I feel like that would make me very nauseous.
Because there's a tremendous amount of forces and all kinds of... when you're moving that fast, there's motions every which way. So I don't know if it's a black hole, but something does happen. So they have to find out what's going on the quantum physics level. So that's as far as I can wrap my head around this topic.
600 million times per minute. That's a lot of spins. Good for you, University of St. Andrews. Now please tell me how I can go back to 1955. That would be awesome. All right, let's see what's on the calendar.
You and your sock hops. Your sock hop will be in 1955. But on Friday, August 30th, the BlackBerry Q10 hits Sprint. So if it's not selling well on Verizon, AT&T, maybe it'll do better on Sprint. Also, DragonCon officially kicks off tomorrow. That's where Tom Merritt, at least I think he's there. I don't know if he's spinning, but he might be.
He's en route, I believe, to DragonCon.
All those Atlanta people.
I hope that plane isn't spinning.
No, I didn't say his plane. Just Tom himself.
Tom himself.
He's like a mega dreidel.
Yeah, he's definitely a mega dreidel.
And that's off the calendar.
That's got to be a new superhero. Mega dreidel. Or perhaps a villain.
Isn't that Red Tornado? Anyway.
Yeah. All right, let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got an email from George who says, you were talking about brain-to-brain control in video games on yesterday's show. Have none of you guys seen the movie Gamer? No, I don't blame you if you haven't. It was a terrible movie. Anyway, in the movie, Rockstar gamers control convicts who fight each other to the death. Is this where we're headed with this technology? Or are smart robots going to control our bodies in the future world of the singularity? I don't know which is worse. Love the show. Well, that's frightening. I haven't seen the movie.
I have seen the movie Gamer. Oh, okay. It is frightening. It's horrible. But yeah, I guess that could happen. If people are going to control each other, they could be made to fight by proxy. So if you're really rich, I'd imagine that'd be a great thing to do. Graphics would look good, you know? Skype in with 3D.
Dan, have you seen the movie Gamer?
I have seen the movie Gamer, and my eyes bled a little bit. But, you know, this is...
Were they related?
A little bit. This is cool, but this is cool, and it's the exact kind of thing that I would want after going to a gaming conference. I don't know how this is going to play in my own game consumption, though.
Well, we will we'll get back to you as we do some trial runs. Thanks for the email.
I was trying to make a pun slowly.
Actually, it was a good slow pun. I like how you drew that out. All right, well, we've come to the end of our show. Thanks so much, Dan Patterson, for joining us once again. Tell folks what you're up to these days, how they can find your work online.
Well, always a pleasure to join you guys. And I am doing some, a lot of data journalism for some all. We are right now working with big sets of data about the spread of prescription drugs and how prescription works in what's called diversion and how the data impacts our understanding of addiction, which is really fascinating research. Next up is a story about the NSA and I'll probably spend a couple months researching the technology components of the Snowden story.
All right. That's awesome. You can also go to twitter.com/Dan Patterson to keep up on all of Dan's tweets, to links to all of the stuff he does. And thanks to everybody also who submitted and voted stories up and down to our subreddit. TechNewsToday.reddit.com is where you can go to let us know the kinds of stories that you would like us to cover. And even if you don't really have an idea, you can at least vote up or down other people's ideas. You help us build our rundown every day. So thanks everybody who participates in that. And if you would like to get a hold of us, you can always contact us. TNT@twit.tv is our email address. 260-TNT-SHOW is our voicemail. Tomorrow we've got Darren Kitchen. He's our Friday regular. We're going to do mimosas. I said it. See you tomorrow.
Oh, wow. All right. You're going to have to live up to that.
I don't know what just happened.
Someone will. Awesome just happened.